This episode of Intelligent Medicine is brought to you by Carlson Fish Oils. Fish oil provides the vital omega-3s, EPA and DHA, which support cardiovascular, brain and nerve, vision, immune system, joint, and skin health. Carlson ensures maximum freshness by managing their fish oils from sea to shelf. All Carlson fish oils are tested by an FDA-registered laboratory for freshness, potency, and purity, and they're available in soft gels and liquid form. For more information, go to carlsonlabs.com. Carlson fish oils are available at fine health food stores nationwide. Welcome to today's Intelligent Medicine Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and today we're going to do something a little different. We're going to do a potpourri of health and nutrition stories. These are stories that sort of ended up on the cutting room floor because on our weekend program we do a variety of features, but we've been getting so many phone calls these days that I haven't managed to squeeze them all in during the limited time available. That's 2 hours each Saturday from noon to 2 p.m. Eastern Time. And, of course, you can listen to the podcast after the program's over, or you can listen to the live stream if your local radio station doesn't carry our program. We have well over 100 affiliates across the United States and in Canada, but some people prefer to listen these days via live stream. And, of course, radio is discretionary these days. If you like a show, just like a TV show, when I watch Game of Thrones, well, I don't watch it live. I watch it a couple days after. Try not to look at the spoiler alerts. Okay, let's start with this story. Say your kid, who is allergic to insect bites and stings, gets bitten by a wasp. He suddenly starts to wheeze. He turns red. And so you rush to get the EpiPen, only to find, as you're desperately clutching the EpiPen and running back to your child, you look at the expiration date, and it says August 2017. And here we are a couple of months beyond that. And so what in the heck is going to happen? Is your child going to die? Well, this is the basis of a story that was written in ProPublica by investigative reporter Marshall Allen. And it has to do with expiration dates on medications. And I believe that there is a real scandal here because expiration dates, it turns out, are kind of a big scam perpetrated by the pharmaceutical industry. In this article, Allen interviews Lee Cantrell, who helps run the California Poison Control System. And Cantrell, in turn, called a researcher at the University of California, Roy Girona, who specializes in analyzing chemicals, and undertook an analysis of drugs that had been sitting around for as much as, get this, 30 years. Now, it is common practice in pharmacies and major medical centers across the country. They routinely toss out tons of even scarce and potentially valuable prescription drugs when they hit their expiration dates. They have to, because there are regulations. And there's liability when you sell an expired drug. I've encountered this in my medical practice because I used to do a lot of allergy testing. And, of course, it was necessary to have resuscitative equipment. A couple of times, patients developed severe reactions after we gave them allergy shots. And so it's necessary to have rescue remedies. I've even managed to resuscitate a patient who was about to check out at 20,000 feet on an airliner. I was called upon, the button went off, and they said, is there a physician on the plane? And I reluctantly got up. And there was a guy who barely could get a breath out. He was allergic to dairy. And somehow he had put some salad dressing on his salad that contained a tiny amount of dairy. He began wheezing. I had to administer epinephrine. And amazingly, on the pain, they didn't have an EpiPen. I had to crack open a vial and load up a syringe and inject him. And I managed to save the day to the applause of people on the flight. The guy pulled out of it, and he was very grateful. But this happens. But let's say something like this transpires in your office as a physician. And unfortunately, bad stuff happens sometimes. Sick people come to the office and say somebody has a heart attack in your office or somebody has an allergic reaction and you administer medication and they die. It happens. I mean, your best efforts notwithstanding. And afterwards, they do a little bit of investigation. Well, what did you administer, doctor? Well, I administered this, that, and the other thing. Can we see the medication that you administered? Well, oh my goodness. The medication that you administered had expired 60 days ago. And so you are liable. A big, great big lawsuit might ensue. And you did all the right things, but he did it with the wrong medication that just by virtue of carelessness, you didn't properly renew. And to a great expense, I would have my nurses go through our crash cart, which contained all the life-saving medication. And we would throw out an enormous amount of stuff. It was expired. And I knew it was probably still good. But it was expired. So even if it was one day expired, if something happened to a patient and you administer to them, well, such are the laws of negligence, medical liability, that you had to have up-to-date medication to technically perform resuscitation properly. Okay? Expiration date is kind of a fuzzy term. The drug labels actually indicate the point to which the FDA, the Food and Drug Administration, and pharmaceutical companies guarantee the effectiveness of medication, typically at 2 or 3 years. Now, that doesn't mean that the medications are ineffective or that they magically turn into dishwater. It just means that there is no guarantee. And oh, by the way, there are perverse incentives for drug makers to go with that particular policy because that's another way to sell a lot of medications to hospitals and so on. To give you an idea of the scale of this, it's estimated that at hospitals across the country, it costs about $800 million per year in terms of throwing out expired medication. One moderate-sized hospital, 240-bed hospital, typical hospital outside of Boston, had to destroy about $200,000 worth of medication last year. It's not even like a major university hospital, just a small community hospital. So $800 million per year. And that doesn't even include the cost of expired drugs at long-term care facilities and retail pharmacies and, of course, in your consumer medicine cabinets where you're encouraged to, you know, look at your medication and throw it out, you know, when it's expired. So what's interesting is that there is an exception made for the government. The federal government has stockpiled massive stashes of medication and antidotes and vaccines in case there's some disaster or an epidemic, and they have exempted themselves from these requirements. So instead, they, from time to time, test these medications to test their quality. That's pretty amazing. But when it comes to consumers, there are different rules. It's gone back at least half a century. The FDA began requiring manufacturers add in expiration information on the label. And most medications, quote, expire after 2 or 3 years. So according to Yan Wu, who's person interviewed for this article for ProPublica. She's part of a focus group of the American Association of Pharmaceutical Scientists that looks at the long-term stability of drugs. She says most companies would rather sell new drugs and develop additional products, there is a perverse economic incentive. Call it planned obsolescence that causes these drugs to get tossed. You know, there's no win for them to undertake studies to see if medication is potent after a certain period of time. So they're not doing the studies. They're investing billions of dollars in research and development. But when it comes to extending the shelf life of drugs, there's not a lot of gain for the drug companies to do that. Among medical professionals, it's an open secret that many drugs maintain their ability to combat ailments well after their labels say they don't. One pharmacist who was interviewed for this article says he sometimes takes home expired over-the-counter medication from his pharmacy so he and his family can use it. So they did a study in 2006. And this is a government doing this. It's part of what's called the Shelf Life Extension Program because they realized how much waste there was in the military, for example. They looked at 122 drugs, and they found that two-thirds of the expired medications were stable every time a lot was tested, and each of them had their expiration dates extended on average by more than 4 years, according to an article in the Journal of Pharmaceutical Sciences. And what's interesting is that, you know, if there was such a problem with expired medications, you would think that there would be reports in the medical literature of people getting an expired medication and coming to harm, or the medication didn't work, or say an EpiPen malfunctioned after it was sitting around for too long. There have been no recorded instances of such harm in all the literally millions of articles that are published in the medical literature. So, The AMA actually undertook an initiative in 2000, the year 2000. They adopted a resolution urging that the shelf life of many drugs seems to be, quote, considerably longer than their expiration dates, leading to, quote, unnecessary waste, higher pharmaceutical costs, and possibly reduced access to necessary drugs for some patients. And the effort fell flat, because it wasn't backed by the drug companies. In fact, it was bucked by the drug companies, so it was dropped. But this may be the turning point, because you may recall that this year, and I reported on this earlier this year in May, that these two guys we mentioned earlier, Cantrell and Girona, these researchers published a study that examined 40 EpiPens and EpiPen Juniors. Now, this is in the wake of this scandal with the EpiPens. The price of the EpiPens was like $400, $500, $600 per pen. I mean, it was getting ridiculous when, you know, every couple of years I have to buy my office new EpiPens in case somebody had an allergic reaction. And I remember when I first started practice 30 years ago, I don't know, maybe they cost $30, $40, $50. But, you know, I was astonished when the nurse said, okay, we'll have to order one because this one's expired. Well, how much is it going to be? So this will be like $450 per pen, a pen that, very unlikely, just like having a fire extinguisher that you would never use. Just, you know. So, but these researchers published a study in May of 2017 that examined 40 EpiPens and EpiPen Juniors. These are the smaller pediatric version that had been expired for between 1 and 50 months. 50 months is 4 years. And these devices had actually been donated by consumers, so they got a lot of wear and tear. They weren't stored under the most optimal conditions. So what they found was that 24 of the 40 expired devices contained at least 90% of their stated amount of epinephrine, which is plenty potent because, you know, all you need is, you know, getting the majority of that epinephrine directly into the bloodstream. All of them, 40 out of 40, contained at least 80% of their labeled concentration of the active ingredient. So the takeaway is that even EpiPens stored in less than ideal conditions for up to 4 years past expiration date still work and certainly are better than nothing. So the answer to our question that we posed in the beginning of this discussion is no, your kid's not going to die, you're gonna have a positive outcome, even with all our medication. I think we really need an initiative in this country to save costs around these devices. All right, this item, and yeah, we're sort of getting fatigue from headlines like this because they just keep getting worse and worse. After a while, it's kind of like the boy cried wolf. Obesity epidemic at new high. Costs $150 billion a year, hurts military recruiting. This is the 14th annual State of Obesity. It's a report from the Trust for America's Health and the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation. They now report that 70% of the nation is obese or overweight. You know, I actually predicted this, is that, eventually there's going to, you know, like in the American Museum of Natural History in New York, they have these dioramas of extinct animals. Eventually behind the glass, they're going to have the last normal weight humans. That'll be, you know, say in 2035, it'll be the very last ones. They'll be stuffed and mounted there. And parents will take their children to see it. And, you know, the kids will exclaim, "Mommy, Mommy, look at that skinny man and that skinny lady." You know, because they will be, by then it'll be, you know, 100% of us will be obese or overweight. Americans continue to get fatter, and it's delivering a huge blow to the country, both in higher healthcare costs and undercutting military recruiting. Okay, this is, you know, this, I've said this in the past. This is a national security issue. The additional health care for obese adults and children costs $150 billion a year and billions of dollars more in lost worker productivity. Okay? It's also costly to the military, said the report. Nearly one quarter of military recruits are rejected because they're obese, and it costs the Pentagon $1 billion a year in added healthcare costs for obese troops and their families. And more stunning, said the comprehensive 101-page report, I guess you can get this online, from Robert Wood Johnson, 70% of today's youth are not fit to serve in the military due to obesity or being overweight, criminal records, drug misuse, or educational deficits. And add one other category, maybe just lewd tattoos. So this is a pretty dire situation. You know, and I have to say, the other day, I was on my bicycle. I wasn't jogging that day. I was on my bicycle. And near where I hang out on summer weekends is a Coast Guard station. And some of the Coast Guard recruits were taking their morning run. And they looked pretty miserable. Now, there are a couple of jackrabbits out in front. They were looking pretty good. They were way out in front. But there are a couple of real lard asses cleaning up the rear. And these were young men in their early 20s. And it ain't easy on a, you know, an 85-degree day for a 235-pound, you know, 6'2", 20-something military recruit who's in poor physical condition to do, you know, a 3 or 4 mile run. And they looked, you know, pretty unhappy, and they were dogging it and out of breath. And those are the ones who were accepted in the military, and many simply wash out. When it comes to states that are most prone to obesity, West Virginia tops it with 37.7% obese. Colorado is at the bottom with 22% obese. Colorado's a healthy state. And there's also something about altitude that tends to make you work a little harder. And Colorado is a very sports-oriented state. You know, a lot of winter sports, a lot of summer sports, a lot of hiking. It is a mecca for people who are sports-oriented. So there are also striking racial and ethnic inequities, with rates above 40% for blacks in 15 states, 35% among Latinos in 9 states, and, you know, possibly because they're also very genetically prone to obesity and metabolic syndrome, because there's a relatively high percentage of Native American blood in many Latinos. And among Navajo Indians, for example, the type 2 diabetes rate in some areas is 80% because exposed to a Western diet after years of relative harsh circumstances and deprivation and high levels of physical exertion, they tend to go towards metabolic syndrome and weight gain. Also, there's an education gap. Obesity rates around 30% higher among adults without a college education. So there you go. Knowledge and awareness make a difference. Now, there's a big debate about whether we should tax soda or whether we should restrict food stamp benefits, now called SNAP, the Supplemental Nutritional Assistance Program, SNAP. Should we restrict them based on certain food criteria? In other words, why is it that you can take your food stamps and buy soda and cookies and sugary desserts when what this is really designed to do is to fend off starvation? And for the life of me, I can't see why not do that. I've seen some arguments made against it, but I suspect that some of the organizations that are fronting out for the, quote, rights of SNAP recipients to receive whatever food they want are secretly or in some cases overtly funded by the beverage industry and by the supermarket industry because it's a big profit center. It's like government subsidized by stuff, and they don't care what stuff you buy at the supermarket, as long as you ka-ching, 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 and the beverage industry doesn't want to be cut out of the deal. And so they come up with arguments like, oh, you know, we don't want to stigmatize these people. You know, how embarrassing would it be? You know, you go to the checkout counter and you got a big bottle of, you know, Pepsi, and they say, no, you can't have that because you are a poor person and we know better for you that's bad for you. So no. It's demeaning. It's demeaning somehow to the poor people who receive SNAP assistance. And I say no. I think that it is in the interest of those individuals. It's in the interest of the country as a whole that we disincentivize people obtaining these types of foods because it's driving a disease epidemic. And look, by the way, another argument against this is that these people are going to buy this anyway. They're hooked on sugar, and then they're going to further impoverish themselves. But that's a little bit like saying, you know, well, maybe we should subsidize cigarettes for these people because these people spend a lot of money inordinately on cigarettes. Well, we don't subsidize cigarettes with food stamps. And so therefore, when the harm is as clear cut as it now demonstrably is, with the science being very, very robust on the relationship between sugar and a wide variety of diseases, let's put a little bit of a speed bump in the way of obtaining these kinds of things. The other issue, of course, is taxing soda. And, you know, that puts more money in government coffers. But the problem is that it's all local, municipal laws in progressive cities where they want to do this. I think they did it in Philadelphia. So what people do is they jump in their cars and they go to Sam's Club or Costco in the suburbs and they buy all their sugary soda there where the laws don't apply. And so there's been a very, very profound drop in sales, overall sales, at some of the markets in these urban progressive centers where they've enacted these laws. That's the net result. So what we need is we need a national uniform policy. Alternatively, you know, people might jump across the border, go to Canada or Mexico, but that, that's probably a less likely scenario if you live in the center of the country. So, you know, what to do, education. As you can see, there's an education gap. So is that college-educated people who are more aware tend to be more health conscious, leaner, exercise more, eat better. Maybe they can afford the food. Yeah, okay, they can buy arugula. They can shop at Whole Foods. With Amazon buying Whole Foods, maybe, just maybe, the foods will become more affordable to the general populace. That would be good. Okay, that's all for this part of today's Intelligent Medicine Podcast. It's a potpourri of health stories that ended up on the cutting room floor. We're reporting on them, and we'll continue in part two, so stay with us.